My name is Erik Jorsted, and this is our fifth and final session in the series that's been going on all week called Faith and Law. Our topic today is called Rethinking Rights in the Liberal Welfare State. And I must confess that of all 10 sessions that I've taught here in the last 2 weeks, this is the one about which I know the least. But it's also the one that I've been looking forward to the most, maybe for precisely that reason. For the last 9 sessions, I've been teaching out of my strength, namely things that I've studied and thought about a great deal before. This is the session that, when I was thinking about doing 10 sessions, I thought, well, we're going to have one that we're just going to play with. I'm going to talk about things that are just sort of starting to form in the back of my mind, and I'm not quite sure where they're going to lead yet, but I can't think of any place better than Holden Village to try to put them together. So we're going to be conducting a kind of experiment in thought today, seeing if we can move beyond a language of rights when we start to talk about our society, and also when we start to talk about our church. Let me say, before I dig into the subject itself, let me say a few words about myself. Why am I talking about a topic like this anyway? Since 1983, I've been a justice consultant with the Office of Church and Society of the American Lutheran Church, which means that I've helped write social statements for them. I've led various projects and trips and so on for that office. And I've focused on criminal justice, the death penalty, and the criminal justice system, but also some broader themes of what is law anyway, and what relationship does law have to Christian believers. And so the series this week has been Faith and Law, giving it a nice specific title like I do to most of my presentations. When I was here 6 years ago, I did a session that was called Meaningless Suffering. So you can tell I have a penchant for nice, simple, narrow topics in what I'm interested in. But since being in the parish in Northwest Detroit, I'm an ALC pastor in Northwest Detroit, and becoming active in my community, I've seen that if I want to work for the betterment of the community where I am, that it's not a matter of good intentions, and it's not a matter of noble theological ideas or ideals or even proper doctrine, but it's a matter of knowing how the power of the community is put together. How does the legal system work? How does the political system impact upon my community? And so on. And that's led me into various endeavors having to do with politics and law, and I'm not going to go into all of those. But it's led me into rethinking the way that our communities are organized. And if the church is going to minister in our communities, we ought to know what's really happening inside of them. Not what we come with our theological presuppositions and sort of look at it and overlay our doctrine on society and say, this is the way society ought to look like. And I'm going to try to do good. I'm going to try to improve society. So I'm going to make it over in this kind of a mold. But instead to sort of lift those theological blinders and presuppositions and try to understand the way society itself is actually put together. And then once we understand the way things are actually put together, to say, okay, now where does my faith lead me? So I've started taking some courses in legal theory and process, as well as being active in political affairs and so on, and read as an amateur on this subject rather widely. So I'm going to share my amateur insights with you this morning, and invite your questions and see where it takes us. I've got 3 questions I want us to look at this morning as we're rethinking rights in the liberal welfare state. And the first question is to start by understanding what is a right. First thing that comes to mind when you hear the word right is you think, well, right and wrong. Right has something to do with morals. There's something about rights that has to do with making things right And Christians talk about righteousness. That has the word right included in it. But rights, in the sense that I want to talk about them, are really something other than these moral overtones of right and wrong. What would be some examples of rights as you would think of them? Maybe that's a place to start in. What rights do you have?
Right to free speech.
Freedom of speech.
Religion.
Freedom of religion.
Assembly.
Freedom of assembly.
What about the right to bear arms?
The right to bear arms. That's right. Where do those rights come from? Why is that a right? Free speech, why is that a right?
Constitution.
From our Constitution. There's something about our political or our governmental structure that says you have these rights. To do certain kinds of things. I would define a right as the sphere of individual freedom over against the claims by the state. What can you do that the state, and by the state I don't mean the state of Washington or the state of Minnesota, but state meaning government, what can you do that the state cannot prevent you from doing? Freedom of speech. The state cannot stop you from freedom of speech. However much the president may disagree with what you're saying, he or she does not have the power to stop you from saying it. Unless it can be shown to be inciting to rebellion or particular kinds of circumstances. Freedom of religion. You have the right to practice your religion, and there's nothing the government can do to stop you. If any of you play cards, you know what a trump is. Whatever else happens to be going on in the card game, if you lay down a trump, it takes priority over whatever else has been laid. Rights are, in a sense, like trumps in a social situation. Another right that you didn't mention is the Fourth Amendment, due process. The right to due process, and that's one that sort of galls most of us, because we see criminals, or people who commit criminal acts, even murders and assaults and so on, who, because their rights of due process were violated by the police or someone in the process of investigation, their case gets tossed out. They go free. We think, what justice is that? But the right of due process trumps the other rights, the other social goals of punishment and so on. So rights are like trumps, protecting individuals. But let's notice where rights come from. If you go back to a philosopher named Hobbes, I don't even know his first name.
Thomas.
Does he have Thomas? Hobbes, when did he live? Here's a historian.
16th century.
16th century, 1500s, about the time of Luther. Hobbes said that human beings in their natural state, if we didn't have any government, kind of like Olden Village, if we didn't have any real government with power to enforce rules if people really decided to break them, what we have, this isn't supposed to be any kind of a pattern here, are individuals who are all doing their own thing. They're all pursuing their own interests. They're all insulated from each other. And they're all competing with each other. It's kind of a picture not unlike Genesis chapter 1, when it says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. There was that sort of primal chaos before God imposed order on the world. Well, according to a philosopher, Hobbes, we are all these kind of individual units, all pursuing our own interests. And I'll put a dot in the middle to show what is it that we're centered upon, what is it that motivates each of us. Well, it's our own interests, whether it's becoming the greatest basketball player in the NBA, or whether it's being the best parent that you can be in your community, whether it's being, you know, whatever it is that's your interest, winning the most important case, or writing the best book, whatever it is that's your passion and motivates you is your interest. And everybody is competing and fighting against everybody else to accomplish their interests. And if we didn't have any kind of government or structure to protect us from one another, everybody would sort of chew each other up. Hobbes called it the war of all against all. And if you see some inner city kind of situations, and maybe some rural situations, sort of the frontier west where there was no law, it was a kind of, however much power you had in your holster, it's the same thing in the inner cities today, however much, you know, how good you are with the piece that you pack, or the gun that you carry, or the blade, or whatever, that's how much power you've got, and that's how you can accomplish what you want for yourself. So in this natural state of all against all, Hobbes said we need to come together. We need someone to protect us from ourselves. And he called that the sovereign, or the state, or in his book Leviathan, which is a wonderfully ironic image for it. But he said we need to give over some of the freedom which we have. In the war of all against all, we all have total freedom to do anything, anytime, to anyone. But he says we need to hand over some of that freedom to the state, to the government, in order to protect us. So I'll agree that I'm not going to murder anybody, as long as you all agree that you're not going to murder me either. And I'll give up my freedom to murder you if we'll all agree together that we're not going to murder each other. Or I'm going to give, I won't steal from you if we all agree together that you're not going to steal from me. And so Hobbes' word was alienate. We alienate our freedom. We hand over our freedom for certain kinds of actions to the state in order to protect us from this war of all against all. What's left, what we don't hand over to the state, is what is our rights. And so John Locke was kind of the next philosopher who developed this theory, and all of this stuff underlies our own Constitution. What does Thomas Jefferson call the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Inalienable.
Inalienable. That's kind of a word we don't use too often. At least, you know, I'm a preacher, and I don't think I've used it in my sermons lately. And they'd need a dictionary if I did, probably. Inalienable. That's the opposite. It comes from Hobbes. You alienate your freedom. There are certain things which cannot be alienated, certain things which cannot be handed over to the state. And that's what rights are. And those inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the real underlying ones that motivated Hobbes and Locke in particular wasn't really freedom of speech, although that was part of it, or freedom of religion, although that was part of it. Freedom of private property was one of the most important rights. That sphere of individual liberty to own property over against the king. Instead of the king owning all the land upon which his subjects worked, this gave the sphere of individual initiative, private property, the space to develop. And if there hadn't been Hobbes, would there have been capitalism? Or is it vice versa? If there hadn't been capitalism, would there have been Hobbes? Well, we'll debate that one endlessly. But in any case, this is the social theory of rights which made the institutions of private property and finally the development of capital and capitalism possible. So rights are the sphere of freedom that we maintain over against the claims of the state. The state can stop us from stealing and murdering, but there are certain things the state can't do. They can't take my property if I followed the rules in obtaining it. The opposite of a state of rights would be what? Totalitarianism. A state like the Soviet Union, where there are no rights, or at least they're incredibly restricted. You can't leave the Soviet Union. We have at least the right to emigrate. That's meted out very carefully there. So that's what I want to say about rights to begin with. We can go at it some more. I've seen some heads nodding as I've been saying this. I assume that's not that you're falling asleep, but that you're agreeing with my presentation so far. This is what rights are. They're these spheres of freedom that we retain against the state. And because of our Constitution, because the Constitution takes priority over any law that's passed, the rights, the Bill of Rights that we have, are these trumps that Congress shall not pass a law abridging the free exercise of religion. Our states and our Congress cannot supersede any of these rights. They're absolute in legal terms. But now I want to go on to my second question. The first question is, what is rights? And this is kind of a starting point to understanding that. The second question I want to ask is rights language appropriate for group or collective agendas? Is rights language appropriate for group or collective agendas? And sort of the second question, is it appropriate for these, let alone for the common good? Is it possible to get the common good out of a discourse of rights? Now, the place where the rubber hits the road on this question has to do with quotas and affirmative action. And that's sort of the rub of the practical issue that I hope we can discuss some, because what I'm looking for here is a way beyond quota language for the New Lutheran Church, in part. I've been arguing against it on the convention floor and elsewhere in the Michigan district. But also for our society, as we're sort of coming up against the limits of what affirmative action can accomplish. The problem is when you use rights language, you alienate a certain amount of your freedom to the state, but it still presupposes that what's important about our political discourse is protecting individuals from the collective, from the state, and that these individual interests, these things at the heart of what we pursue, is the sort of the sphere of freedom that we're protected from, our liberty. If liberty is our fundamental principle, how do we get together on a common kind of agenda? And once you use rights language, for example, civil rights, well, I don't want to press that one too hard, but affirmative action. Let's say quotas in contracts for, it's a hard one to talk about because we're all white in this room, but I hesitate to even talk about black-white relations if it's an all-white group. But let's take a stab at it. I'll violate my own usual principle here. Because Holden's so white, I mean, we can't help, but we could never talk about it if I stay true to that. So if the awarding of contracts and applications to St. Olaf College or wherever was determined on the basis of a quota that 12%, or what is it now, 14% of all the contracts or the students had to be black, and for the purpose of correcting the year's worth of past abuses and the fact that there was discrimination for so many years that now there needs to be special preference in order to come up to the place of equality, advancing the good of the black community, the best thing that we can do is to give them the right to 14% of the contracts. They are entitled to 14% of the admissions. The problem is that this kind of rights language, we deserve such and such, insulates whoever has that right from the rest of society. Why has there been so much hostility against notions of affirmative action? Because it sets groups in conflict with each other, each of which is fighting over the rights and the goals that they can protect for themselves. So how can you bridge, how can you cross the gap of this sphere of individual freedom, this ability to do what you want to do, when we're talking about more than one person doing what they want to do? When we have blacks and Spanish, Hispanic and women and all kinds of people who are claiming rights to various social goods, can a group interest or a common good ever be promoted by the over-against kind of language of rights? Rights, by their definition, set up a barrier. They set up this sphere for an individual which says the government cannot cross this barrier. This inside here is mine. But if you're talking about developing a common good, a common agenda to help overcome racism or sexism in society, does it help to start by setting up the language of barriers, of over-againstness, of the right of the oppressed groups to these social resources? Or does that simply exacerbate and increase the hostility and the discrimination and so on within society? Does that really overcome? You can tell I'm sort of putting out some tentative feelers here, and I see some furrowed brows instead of nodding heads this time. So I want to go at this with you. Rights are individual and isolating, and if we're talking about group or collective goals, I'm not sure rights is the best language. And I think, as I read it, and I'm just an amateur student of what's happened in the last 25 years, but what's happened in the Black Agenda, for example, is the movement from civil rights in the late 50s through the mid-60s to political power, which is the rise of the black mayors and elected representatives and so on, to economic development. And the buzzword in the black community these days, as far as I see, is not rights. And it's not even political power, although Jesse Jackson is a distinct phenomenon that shows the vitality of that vision still. But it's economic power. How I interpret that is that in the black community, they've come up against the barrier of what rights can accomplish. That you can only go so far with the walls. That rights language can only get you so far. And you can guarantee various kinds of formal equality and formal rights. But that does not a just or equal society make. Then they tried political power and said, well, rights can only be, it's only respected insofar as the state respects them, and so have gained a great deal of political power, but that hasn't brought about equality. If anything, things have gotten worse in the last 10, 15 years. And now the buzzword is economic development, which is a different kind of language. And I'd like to move on that note to my third question, which is there a language other than rights? Is there a better language we can use to talk about our common goals? And the rubber hits the road again on the question of affirmative action and on the question of quotas in the New Lutheran Church. I think the Church has kind of gotten stuck, especially with the Commission on the New Lutheran Church, in the old rights language, still kind of fighting the battles of the late 60s and the early 70s, and hasn't caught up with the black community, for one thing. And maybe with some others. And it's a particularly problematic if we take a gospel vision of Galatians 3:28. In Christ there is neither male nor female, slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, Scythian nor barbarian, or what's the rest of the quote. There's some very particular kinds of things, people that are talked about in there. But you are all one in Christ. If there's a vision of a unity, of a common good, that transcends our differences, is language of quotas, language which sets people over against each other and sets up barriers, is that the right kind of language? I'm not so sure. But is there a better language? Can we talk about collective agendas? Can we talk about the common good in a more productive way? And I think so, but I'm not sure. A book I highly recommend to you that I'm going to read a few passages from, who suggests a new kind of language, is called The Needs of Strangers by a philosopher named Michael Ignatieff. I-G-N-A-T-I-E-F-F. It's a strange last name. I-G-N-A-T-I-E-F-F. Ignatieff. He lives in England. Writes, this is Penguin Publishing. But the subtitle is interesting. An essay on privacy, or rights, this individual sphere as we've been talking about. An essay on privacy, solidarity, what is it that can bridge the gap of individual interests, and the politics of being human. And he wants to argue that there's a different kind of language, the politics of being human, which can transcend the paradox between privacy and solidarity. Let me read a little bit from him, and then we'll have some discussion. He talks about, he opens the book by talking about in his apartment in London, there's a back alley with garbage cans, and about the bag ladies and the poor who come rummaging through the garbage looking for food or scraps of clothing and so on. And he says, my encounters with these people are a parable of moral relations between strangers in the welfare state. They have needs, and because they live within a welfare state, these needs confer entitlements or rights to the resources of people like me. How many of you pay more in taxes than you receive from the government in pension? Well, I won't ask for show of hands, but it's probably a majority. At a certain point, you start receiving back if you're on Social Security, but I certainly pay a lot more than I get back. But their needs of these poor confer rights, their right to the resources of people like me. Their needs and their entitlements establish a silent relationship between us. As we stand together in line at the post office while they cash their pension checks, meaning their Social Security, that's in the British language, some tiny portion of my income is transferred into their pockets through the numberless capillaries of the state. The mediated quality of our relationship seems necessary to both of us. They are dependent on the state, not upon me, and we are both glad of it. Yet I am also aware of how this mediation walls us off from each other. We are responsible for each other, but we are not responsible to each other. He goes on, my responsibilities towards them are mediated through a vast division of labor. In my name, a social worker climbs the stairs to their rooms and makes sure that they're warm and clean as they can be persuaded to be. When they get too old to go out, a volunteer will bring them a hot meal. When they can't go on, an ambulance will take them to the hospital, and when they die, a nurse will be there to listen to the ebbing of their breath. It is this solidarity among strangers, this transformation of needs into rights and rights into care, that gives us whatever fragile basis we have for saying that we live in a moral community. This is the society of strangers established by the liberal welfare state, the state which provides persons with the rights to medical care, to food, to education, to a kind of certain minimal level of human subsistence. These are considered rights, and people don't too often, if you, you know, it's interesting how it sort of bugs you when a beggar comes up to you and asks for money. Or when someone comes to my church door asking for money, I'll usually say, well, you know, come in, sit down in my office, let me pull out my directory, I'll put you in touch with the social service agencies that can really do you some good. You know, I can give you $5, so what? But that's not going to do you any good. Let me get in touch with the people who are supposed to help you. I'd rather shuffle it off to another stranger who can take care of this stranger and take care of them. But he wants to argue for a different kind of language than rights, which sets us up as strangers, which is why black and white and male and female seem not to be able to talk to each other in a society of rights. He wants to argue for a language of human needs and human potential. That word has overtones from the 70s here. Let's say human flourishing. He wants to say that the government should take care of human needs, but that there is such a thing as human flourishing, which is beyond the scope of the government to accomplish. Let me read a little bit more here and see if I'm making any sense. The distinction I want to make is one between needs which can be specified in a language of political and social rights and needs which cannot. In the attempt to defend the principle that needs do make rights, It is possible to forget about the range of needs which cannot be specified as rights and to let them slip out of the language of politics. Rights language offers a rich vernacular for the claims an individual may make against the collectivity, but it is relatively impoverished as a means of expressing individual needs for the collectivity. It can only express the human ideal of fraternity as mutual respect for rights. The most we can do when we get together is respect the fact that we each have rights and individual spheres of action. And it can only defend the claim to be treated with dignity in terms of our common identity as rights-bearing creatures. Yet we are more than rights-bearing creatures, and there is more to respect in a person than his rights. And he goes on, and here's kind of the rub of it. It is because money cannot buy the human gestures which confer respect. It is because rights cannot guarantee this human respect as an entitlement that any decent society requires a public discourse about the needs of the human person. It is because fraternity, love, belonging, dignity, and respect cannot be specified as rights that we ought to specify them as needs and seek with the blunt institutional procedures at our disposal to make their satisfaction a routine human practice. At the very least, if we had a language of needs at our disposal, we would be in a better position to understand the difference between granting people their rights and giving people what they need. I am saying that a decent and humane society requires a shared language of the good. The one our society lives by, a language of rights, has no terms for those dimensions of the human good which require acts of virtue, which cannot be specified as a legal or civil obligation. Well, that's kind of complex stuff here. I hope it's coming across in the reading. He's arguing for a different kind of vocabulary of meeting human need instead of granting people their rights. Because what is it about a need as opposed to a right? A right sets us over against one another. But what about a human need, like, say, dignity? That's something we have in common. Rights separate, needs unite. Because needs are what we have together simply as human beings. The politics of being human is the politics of caring for one another in our needs, for dignity, for respect, for solidarity, for belonging, and so on. And so a language of need, an interesting sort of corollary that he doesn't develop, and Mario Cuomo is the one who does it better than anyone else these days, is the political discourse of family and talking about society as a family. And I'm reminded of the line from a poem. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in.
That's Jim's favorite quote.
Those of you who have children in their 20s, who are returning to the nest. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. That's a language of need. When you need, when you have a need, home is where your need is met and where they have to meet your need. They have to care for you. A family language is a language of needs, of caring for needs, for respect and belonging, and so on. Do you have a right? I mean, do you charge rent when the person comes back? Do you put it in the language of rights? You know, I have a right to be here, I'm your son, I'm your daughter. Well, that just doesn't really occur to you. And what is it that brings together? It's the common sense of need. So a language of human need would transcend or replace a language of rights and potentially create some sense of solidarity. The problem is that some of these words I'm using, dignity, respect, family, and so on, are so overused in political discourse that they've lost some of their punch. But if someone like Cuomo can revitalize the concept of family in political discourse, he'll have changed our whole notion of who we are as a people. instead of a safety net, which is a language of rights. If you fall, at least, you know, you have a right to be caught and kept from dying. But it's not a language of care. It's not a language of respect. It's not a language of dignity, that's for sure. Family is a whole different notion of who we are. And I'm not starting the Cuomo for President campaign here, but just noticing the moral dimensions of the discourse of one of our leading politicians these days. So how can we do this without quotas? Do we still need quotas? How can the church respect who we are as individual human beings and trust to human dignity and care without having to institutionalize it in the barrier-creating form of rights and quotas? I've got a few more things written on my paper, but I think I've talked long enough. Where have we come so far? Have I stirred up the waters, or have I brought some new ideas?
Well, in Minneapolis, with the hiring for police and the fire departments, why should the Native Americans trust the power establishment when, after all the years for volunteers, they don't have very many blacks or Native Americans on the police or fire departments in Minneapolis? The only way they can prove that they are worthy of being hired as police or fire, you know, officers, is to have a quota so they have a chance. I mean, there's a lot of Native Americans who live in Minneapolis. This is a specific example.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps account for much of the radical nature of the, you know, politically radical nature of the Indian movement in the city. So mm-hmm. they don't see no reason for trusting the whites without quotas.
Well, you know, the past patterns of discrimination would certainly prove that, or certainly tend to establish that. So how do you create, if the goal is to create a society where it doesn't matter if you're Native American or black, but you can simply become, you can simply flourish as a human being, how do we get there? Is a quota kind of a necessary evil to rectify past evils for the sake of creating this possible future good? That's an arguable point, or defensible point. Or has it become a barrier itself that prohibits the possibility of creating in some new kind of way that society where all people can flourish? Is the best we can hope for, and maybe this is what Reinhold Niebuhr would say, and he might support quotas on this point, the best we can hope for is conflicting group interest? Or can we transcend it?
I think your parallel of rights and Trump was an excellent one. And I think any of us who have played games with Trump, and the opponent comes up with a bunch of Trump and just mm-hmm. completely cleans us out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that puts you in the position of the white person who's unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And who finds that his potential job mm-hmm. is taken away by that quota.
It's been trumped.
Right, it's been trumped.
Yeah.
And in Spokane, we have a similar quota system and so forth, and we just had a report from the city council within the last 2 weeks. And what they found was that they met their affirmative action goals, but the people turned over. They were evidently recruited away by other people who had affirmative action goals.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a small pool of qualified people who are subject to affirmative action, it really doesn't accomplish anything. It doesn't get it to this uneducated black, Native American, or whatever. That individual doesn't make it past there. You get the one who's educated, and they go to the city, they go to the county, they go...
A great illustration of that's in education, too. I mean, if Harvard has a 14% quota,
mm-hmm.
If, you know, maybe 5% instead of 14 would get in if you simply took the same line, and it's clear it's just a lower score that's accepted for different ethnic and racial groups in order to meet the quota. So that 14% goes to Harvard. Well, then Columbia, which is a half notch below, will take the next 14%, and so on. By the time you get to a state university or something, most of the most qualified people are off somewhere else and tend to flounder around in the lower part of their class and not do very many people very much good.
Another one, so we don't have the women-men thing, is just another one, is that in Northfield, it's true everywhere, it's the post office. And an old classmate of yours, Luann Matheson, was my mail deliverer for a long time. I don't even call her a mailman anymore, so I think I'm making progress on that. But she was trumped by a veteran who came in, and since he had more points as being a veteran of the military, he got the job, and she is now the substitute, working on holiday, not holidays, but working, you know, whenever the pickup, and she's mm-hmm. better qualified. She has more experience, all the rest of these things, but he's a U.S. veteran who gave his dedication to the military, and therefore... And who's going to argue with the veterans groups? You take American Legion and VFW down in Washington, they've got clout.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan put on their VFW and American Legion caps when they go out to politics. Both of them do. You bet.
Sure.
Well, you had the same thing in union setup, too.
Yeah.
I had been working on this job for nearly 10 years. My boss informed me that when this job came up, I would get it. And I'd been on the job about... 2-3 months, and he said, I'm going to have to take you off the job. And I said, what's the perks? So, problem. And I'm not cutting the mustard. Doing a fine job, but Clarence Strom's got 6 months seniority, and he wants the job. You see, it takes away incentive, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what, where the notion of rights does work is when it applies to individuals and creates the space for incentive to become who you can be. But when you apply it to groups, then the incentive is to become a part of that privileged group, not to develop your own capacities. And so if you happen to be the veteran or the person with the seniority, what you're working for all the time is not to become, not to express yourself, not to develop your own potential, but to become a part of the group that's got the claims, that's got the benefits over against the rest. And everyone suffers as a process, in the process. Not everyone, once you got the rights.
To make it more practical, could you give us an example of what they're discussing quotas for in your work with the church? Is it so many black pastors per district, so many women pastors per state, or what are you talking
about? Not having to do with pastors, but with voting delegates and decision-making assemblies, chiefly. So at your district convention, this couldn't be accomplished in North Dakota. I'm not sure there's, enough blacks in North Dakota to qualify. Certainly would be in Southeast Michigan. But at your district convention and at your national convention, there shall be, is the language, 10% who person of color or whose primary language is other than English. There shall be 50% women, and so on. And the one of the arguments they make to support it is that right now in the ALC, for example, there shall be 60% lay and 40% clergy. Or is it? No, it's 50-50 now at the National Convention. And we sort of divvy that up, and nobody feels there's anything particularly bad about setting quotas in terms of clergy and lay. But when it comes to black and white and male and female, then setting those kinds of specific quotas, it so happens the ALC is 99.3% white. 99.3. It's the most homogenous, it's the most white mainline church in the nation. It's the most racially segregated, if you want to use that language, church in the nation. And
one
so
of the
quotas
things you
are.
Say, like quotas, do quotas a lot of times turn down people who are eligible but are not going to get in because of the quota? And they're going to reduce to a lower level of, what do you say, advertising or. Level of, precedent of being high, and mm-hmm. but they're still eligible. Now when we get down to this, we had an incident in our family. Our boy was chosen to go to MIT, and he took his master's degree there, and they sent him on that he could go on and take his doctor's degree. He says, turned down his doctor's degree because he says, I can't talk to common people when I get up that high. Mm-hmm. He is a good teacher to you and I. But he says, when I get up there, I learn a different language. So he says, I'm a different level with them. I can't teach them. He chose to teach you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what Henry Nouwen calls downward mobility. Instead of the upward mobility, where the higher you get, the better you are. Accepting the fact that that higher isn't necessarily better for accomplishing certain things.
Who says you are better?
Yeah. Well, you can, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, who established these quotas? The church body, American Lutheran Church?
Well, that's one thing I want to, I'm leaving Holden later today and find out in the news, since we don't know what up here, we don't even know what the vote was yet up here. But, was the last 3 days there's been debate and amendments, and whether, I know there's a strong move in the ALC to oppose the quotas, and I don't know whether that's been amended or not. It was the CNLC, the Commission of the 70 for the Lutheran Church, who developed the system. But when this commission itself was formed on the basis of quotas, the 70 were selected according to quota schemes, then it's not too surprising that that's what they come out with. I'm not against numerical goals and the hope that the ALC would become more of an inclusive church. But the New Lutheran Church would look more inclusive. But I'm still troubled by this stuff.
I think it was the Thursday paper, and of course our paper doesn't have much church news, but it was a one sentence that indicated that the goal, that the quotas were passed.
Okay, the LCA has strongly supported them.
And I don't remember the total sense
of
the
article. And the ALC has mostly opposed them.
But. Yeah, I was surprised to hear you saying that you were opposing it, because I thought it was it had already been accomplished.
Well, then I'll have to live with it in one way or another, but I'm a writer, I need an issue. So.
I have issues.
Okay, so am I, so go ahead.
if the church is 99.3% white, how are you ever going to make it inclusive unless you have quotas?
Well, right now we're 99.3% white. Mm-hmm. And when the ALC was formed in 1962, we were 99.4% white. Mm-hmm. Wow. 24 years of good intentions hasn't changed things much. But then again, 24 years of very hard work by a number of very committed and sincere people has also not changed things much, and is an institutionalizing of the ideal. If you can set a numerical ideal, why should the ALC be 10% other than white? You could argue that one theologically, whether that really is the ideal, theological ideal. Is that the business of the church to be weighing numbers like that, other than just preaching a gospel of inclusiveness? And is the church subject to, accountability on the basis of numbers like that? Is the church a failure if it's not 10% other than white? That's a pretty narrow and peculiar reading of a couple of verses in the New Testament. But I don't think there's very many people in the Lutheran Church who argue against the goal of inclusiveness. But the question is how to get there. And what I'm arguing is I'm not sure rights language, over againstness, is the way to build particularly a church committed to unity in Christ. I'm not sure I've come up with the best language. I'm offering a language of family as an alternative, but that needs some development.
I have a second question.
Sure.
The family ideal is great, but that's only possible in a small community, so like the base churches in Central America, they seem to be working on this family idea.
I'm not arguing against that. That brings in an important point. I'm not arguing against rights in the specific constitutional sense. There are individual trumps that we ought to have of due process, freedom of speech, religion, and so on. Those are crucial. The question is the extension of that kind of rights language to group goals. And that's what I'm perplexed about and troubled a bit by, and I forgot what my second point was. What was your question again?
Her second point?
I
didn't have a second point.
Oh, okay.
No, I just said that it's only possible in small communities.
Oh, small communities, right. Small right. Communities. And it's interesting, his last chapter in here is about Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the late 1700s, who argued for small communities of political solidarity. And solidarity trumped liberty, and Rousseau jettisoned the basic rights of liberty that we want to keep in our society. But it was only by insulating a community entirely to the broader pressures of the economic sphere in particular that he was able to accomplish that kind of utopia, even in thought. And so it's only kind of in small, personal, face-to-face kinds of settings where that's possible. But I'm still longing that The key is to put into tension two goals, one of which is the language of rights and to recognize individual freedom, but the other is to develop a language of solidarity, a language of the common good, of what we have in common and can work towards. And where the Democratic Party has lost the majority in the last decade is largely through the caucuses. And it's seen as, you know, why was Walter Mondale so unsuccessful in 84? It was partly because there was the black community and the union and the NOW and so on, and it was kind of a collection of interest groups. But there wasn't a whole lot, at least it didn't come through clearly, the theme of who we are and who we become as a nation, which a president is supposed to embody. He's not just a mediator of interest groups, but articulates a theme. And Ronald Reagan, for all the lack of what the safety net accomplishes, is able to articulate a theme of who we are as a nation, as the beacon of democracy and a place for initiative. He at least articulates a common good.
What's the seat of the problem in the first place, for example, in the church? Isn't it prejudice? We're all one in Christ Jesus, so what difference does it make if you're a minority? The seat of the problem is prejudice. How do you overcome that? That seems to me would be where you should start.
Well, that's a very good point, and that's where language of family might help, to realize we are brothers and sisters. And as my friends in the black community have said, I don't know how many times to me, you know, when we're each cut, we both bleed red. When we're cut, we both bleed red. And that sense of we're part of the same human family together.
I can't see where quotas, when there's so many whites. For example, if I were a black, one of the few black, I wouldn't know anything about writing any of this. I don't have too much of an education, and I'm just using this as an example. Well, because my skin was black, I should be in there doing something that's going to affect a multitude of people? That absolutely is nonsense. And yet I can see the other. It's prejudice.
Yeah, so how do you overcome the prejudice?
Yeah, how do you?
Yep. And on the one hand, the gospel, on the one hand, the justice agenda is for the New Lutheran Church, this organization, which has taken quotas as their chief cause.
You have to overcome it by finding, why are you prejudiced?
We'll get to the root cause.
That's right. Education.
Yep. Well, the Justice Agendas group has argued that you change beliefs by changing actions, and that you can't really change the human heart. What you do is change the way people behave, and eventually you're going to change their attitudes. And so you need quotas in order to change the actions, make it officially inclusive, and then after you've rubbed shoulders enough, you're going to start to realize that we're all in common and so on. I'm arguing, I guess, in the reverse, that attitudes inform actions. Maybe there's a tension between the two, but that if we get somehow at a vision of overcoming these barriers through a language like family, a language of common human need and dignity, then actions will follow. Well, I don't know about that. Maybe I'm utopian like Rousseau.
You can't legislate behavior.
No. Well, behavior is the one thing you can legislate. You can't legislate attitudes. Beliefs.
But that part of behavior.
It's sort of, okay. If you say that, then I'd agree with you. But otherwise, I guess I would say it's the other way around. That what you can't legislate is you can't legislate prejudice itself or attitude,
right.
But you can stop people from discriminating in hiring and so on, contracts awarding and so on. You can change behavior with legislation, and in changing the language from rights to needs, you've said, well, politics can't accomplish everything in this case. You've said, well, maybe politics is only about rights, and we have to look to some other means, church or something else, to accomplish the goals. I saw a hand over here.
I just think, too, it really comes down to your own individual heart and developing friendships. I was in inner city Omaha for 7 years, and I must admit I had a lot of prejudice. And it was really getting to know individuals, especially one close friend, and then asking God to break a lot of that down. Because I didn't grow up around black people. I never saw a black person that was 10 or 12 years old.
As long as that,
so
for me,
so it comes down to individual, your own individual heart, and then out of that you get right action. I've seen that in my own life.
Mm-hmm. that's the kind of thing which the church should be particularly good at, is crossing those boundaries. Well, what's the most segregated hour of the week? You know, 11 o'clock Sunday morning.
I think this reflects back to the text study that we had earlier this morning.
Yeah, wasn't it then?
Part of the Luke 14 text talks about the host inviting the poor, the maimed, the blind,
mm-hmm.
the people that we don't usually see. So it starts with invitation.
Mm-hmm. Well, quotas in one sense could be seen as a type of invitation. We're saying we want you to be a part of things. But on the other hand, it's not really like an invitation. It's like putting on handcuffs and saying, come here.
Yeah. Maybe invitation on beginning at the home or family level. And then
at a more personal kind of level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I see the hope in the fact that so many white couples are adopting minority children.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have a real family raising children of a different background and color.
Yeah.
I don't know, I think that's one.
That's a wonderful, I mean, speaking of family transcending racial barriers, that's, you know, literally the yeah. case.
And then they situation. Will get a good education and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'd also, I think I'm arguing in here somewhere too in terms of economic development in the black community, saying it's more than give us ours, but we're going to create ours. There's an increasing emphasis on self-reliance. And writers like Glenn Lowry, in particular, who teaches at Harvard as a black sociologist, who emphasizes that kind of self-reliance that's developing. Yeah.
Is justice one of the critical themes of the merger?
Yes, it is. It sure is. It's really come to the fore in the CNLC, the commission that's drawn up the form for the new Lutheran
Church. What are some of the other critical themes?
Well, scripture was one of them, but that's been settled for the most part. Interpretation of scripture. Pensions is probably the most critical. Whether Jesus, because he called 12 disciples, meant it to be 12%. or 9, which the ALC says is liberal, because their actuarial table sage ought to be 8 point something. They think they're giving in by saying 9. So that and that's facetious, but it's true that really is a crucial issue. We could discuss that one for another hour. But justice is at the heart of it. And so I'm raising this sort of as a way of thinking about society. You know, at the beginning, I said what I hope that we can do is to not just look at society through the eyes of our theological presuppositions, but to see what's really happening. And I've done a history of sort of a social philosophy here, or a history of political theory in this rights language, to try to understand what's happening in society. And then now when the church tries to develop a justice issue, should we simply adopt a language from society, or is there some kind of new language which we can learn, a language of family and human need? We've given a stab at it. I'm not sure where we've gotten. It's interesting that so many of us have experiences, negative experiences related to quotas and so on, and it's rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, and I want to give people permission to talk about that.
On your heading up there, rethinking rights and parents in the liberal welfare state, what was your reason for adding that?
Oh, because that's what this book is about.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And in particularly the needs of strangers,
okay.
and how we become strangers to one another, and we turn over human need to the entitlement notions of the state, and we no longer have that family, that contact with one another. But broader than that, what I think the church has done is adopted the rights language of the liberal welfare state. As we talked about at our forum last night, kind of baptizing the liberal wing of the Democratic Party as the church and society mission of the church. And I'm sympathetic to that. I'm not quite there, but that's kind of what's happened with the rights language too, I think.
We had a talk from a lady who came from Cuba. She chose to go out of Cuba under communism then. And she said, come to Florida first, and she wanted to visit some friends of hers that were black in Florida. No, you may not visit them. She says, you will get in trouble down there.
Mm.
Why, she said, I never heard of that. We do them so much different than we did in Cuba that they respected them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't discriminate against them, but she says, we didn't socialize. Our fun times were not together.
Mm-hmm.
And we do so much different here. And she says, why? Did slavery do it?
Sure did.
I think so.
Sure did. We've got that particular legacy of horrible injustice to to deal with deep in our psyche, as well as the Native Americans, which in Minneapolis you deal with so directly, even more than the black issue. Well, any parting, profound words of wisdom that's going to resolve everything for us? It's 12 minutes to 12, and
well,
the bell is going to ring in a minute.
Well, this must also be true in other countries. I was really surprised. We have a Hungarian family of refugees. We just work in the town where I come from. And after much searching, they did find a little job for this man at minimum wage. And he was really put down. He said, he doesn't speak English just by words. He said, "Nigger, Indian." In other words, what he was conveying was, it wasn't good enough for him. That was a job for the nigger and the Indian. So he must have gotten that somewhere.
He learned that in a hurry about America.
He sure did.
That's part of our vocabulary from wherever he started to learn English. That's a sorry commentary on group oppression.
So I don't know whether that came across the pond with him or whether you already learned it here.
Interesting. Well, that's a kind of parting, that's a good parting shot about how deeply entrenched prejudice is. And